Eric
You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Drew Surrett. I'm here on behalf of the appellants, Brian D. Parrish and Teresa D. Parrish. Assignment of Error 1 in this case turns on a jurisdictional question, but it has significant practical implications for homeowners foreclosed upon in Virginia. The position espoused by the appellee in this case would render many borrowers defenseless in maintaining possession of their homes in the face of a wrongful foreclosure. And this defenselessness is based on the claim by the appellees that the deed that's recorded in the land record sets up a presumption that's not capable of being rebutted.
Why would they be defenseless to a claim of wrongful foreclosure? Why can't they simply object to the wrongful foreclosure and litigate?
Are you in the unlawful detainer case? The issue is of course possession. In many post foreclosure lawsuits, the defendant in that case, out of state banks, Fannie Mae, who is not a citizen of Virginia, Freddie Mac, they all routinely remove these cases to the federal courts. The position in the appellee's brief that removal is an unlikely possibility is simply not accurate. Those cases are removed, and once that occurs, the Anti-Injunction Act bars the plaintiff in that now removed federal court case.
I get that argument, but can we say that the common law, which is what we're talking about as codified in these statutes, should be changed because of the possibility of removal under federal practice?
Your Honor, I submit respectfully that we are not asking for an express change in the common law. There are cases cited by the in the appellee's brief that involve questions of title in unlawful detainer cases. For example, this case of Harrison v. Middleton involved an unlawful detainer where there was a deed. There was a deed by the defendant in the unlawful detainer, and that defendant came into court and presented evidence that there was some fraud in the deed, or he didn't understand the recitals in the deed when he signed it. And based on that, brought a challenge to the unlawful detainer. And what that case says is, if a deed be misread or misexpounded to an unlettered man, this may be shown on non est factum because he's never assented to the contract. So if a man be imposed upon and signs one paper while he believes he is signing another, he cannot be said to have assented and may show this on non est factum. Now, really what that means is the defendant in that case is coming in and saying, I didn't execute this deed. There's a problem with the acknowledgement. There was some fraud. I think, and I submit to the court, that that's factually similar to this circumstance where a borrower gives a foreclosing creditor or creditor the right to foreclose under certain circumstances, not under all circumstances, and where the defendant in the unlawful detainer comes in and says, there is a problem with this deed. It's not based on the fact that that defendant didn't sign the deed. It's based on the fact of a defect in the foreclosure, and I submit that it's similar to this case that I just cited. Additionally, another one of the cases that was cited in the appellee's brief, that case is Grundy v. Golf. One of the jury instructions in that case says the following. It's an unlawful detainer case based on the town of Grundy wrongfully removing posts off the defendant's or the plaintiff's property. One of the jury instructions is as follows from that case. The plaintiff is entitled to the possession of this land if the evidence satisfies you by a preponderance thereof that she has the title to the said strip of land. That was not a specific issue on the unlawful detainer appeal. However, that is a case that goes back to the 1950s, I believe, and I submit it establishes the fact that in some instances in unlawful detainer, the issue of title will be a matter for the trial court to determine. This is so even in one of the examples that's pointed out in the appellee's brief of how an unlawful detainer defendant in a post-foreclosure context could defend against an unlawful detainer without raising the issue of title. In the appellee's brief, it says, well, the Virginia General Assembly allowed indigent defendants additional time to post the appeal bond so they could defend against these post-foreclosure unlawful detainers in limited circumstances. One of those circumstances being, in the appellee's brief, that the foreclosing creditor had conveyed their interest in the property before bringing the unlawful detainer action. Clearly, that defense pointed out in the appellee's brief, the appellee's brief, is an issue of title. It involves a question who has the ownership of the property. And I submit in this case, the general district court where these cases are filed is necessarily making a determination as to the issue of title. That's so because they're coming in with a deed and saying, based on our title that's recited in this deed that occurs through a non-judicial foreclosure process, we are entitled to possession of the property.
Okay, let's actually, I'm going to walk through that rather slowly. In order to come in on an unlawful detainer, they have to have possession. Correct?
The
constructive possession.
The defendant?
Yeah. The plaintiff on an unlawful detainer. Excuse me, I apologize. The defendant has to have possession.
Yes,
one of the elements. The plaintiff to come in, pardon me. Now, the possession is constructive possession. Is that correct? The bank isn't actually occupying the home at this point.
The bank is seeking possession of the property. Yes,
that's wrong. That's why I asked it first. The bank is seeking possession under the unlawful detainer. The bank has a title. It's alleging a title, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
You are disputing the bank's title because the foreclosure was improper, correct?
Yes, it is challenging the foreclosure.
So. Okay. Where in the record do you assert the facts of why you're challenging it?
Your Honor, that was asserted in the answer to bill of particulars that was filed in the general district court. There are affirmative averments set out, and I'm looking for the joint appendix that contains that so I could direct Your Honor to that page. That's on pages... ...60 and 61 of the joint appendix. And of course, this is related to assignment of error too, which I think is a question of import for this court, because I don't think there's ever been a decision about whether when you appeal, there's never been a decision by this court of whether when you appeal a case from the general district court, are the pleadings from that case directly before the circuit court on appeal. And of course, that's one of the reasons we assigned error to that, to ask the court to issue a ruling on that question. Bill of Particulars and Grounds of Defense are before the circuit court, then we've set forth the defense in pages 60 and 61 of the appendix in response to the Bill of Particulars. If the Bill of Particulars and Grounds of Defense are not before the circuit court on appeal, there was no basis for the circuit court to grant summary judgment to the plaintiff because there were material issues of fact in dispute. The basis for the court's granting summary judgment was twofold. One, you cannot try title in an unlawful detainer. Therefore, there can be no challenge to the underlying foreclosure sale. So our clients were not permitted to challenge that sale. Two, that the Bill of Particulars and Grounds of Defense established that there were no material facts in dispute as to the issue of whether Fannie Mae had a deed, whether the parishes were in possession of the property, and therefore the court granted summary judgment. So if the court finds that the bill of particulars and grounds of defense were not before it, before the circuit court, then the judgment, the summary judgment, should not stand on appeal. And moving forward onto this question of whether the common law permits a challenge.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, Your Honor.
At this point, why wouldn't the sensible way to synthesize these cases, including Harrison and others, be to analogize to cases where, like in criminal court, you come in with a conviction for a recidivism charge? Generally speaking, you can't collaterally attack the prior conviction. But, of course, the prosecution has to bring in credible evidence that this was, in fact, a conviction entered by a court, blah, blah, blah. Why wouldn't that analogy apply very well here, which is you can't collaterally attack title of record that's prima facie unassailable. In other words, you can't try title. But, of course, you have to bring in evidence that proves this is title of record. And if someone comes in with evidence that says, no, there's actually a deed after this deed where they sold it to someone else, then you haven't made your prima facie showing. Wouldn't that reconcile some of the cases and provide a synthesis of the common law rule?
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree for three reasons. One, the statute relied upon by Fannie Mae is 8.01-389. That statute provides that the recitals in the deed are prima facie evidence of the facts stated therein. Prima facie does not mean unassailable, and it's capable of being rebutted on its face as that term is ordinarily used. Two, I think Section 16.1-93 and 16.1-114.1 have some relevance to this case because they provide, 16.1-93 provides that every action or other proceeding in a court not of record should be tried according to the principles of law and equity, and when the same conflict, the principles of equity shall prevail. 16.1-114.1 carries that proposition forward into an appeal in the circuit court. The argument that's made by the appellee in this case is a technical, legal, jurisdictional argument. The General Assembly has said in these statutes that the principles of equity shall prevail in trials of these types of cases.
Where there's conflict, otherwise law follows equity.
And I submit in this case where a defendant is challenging a foreclosure sale that occurs without any judicial imprimatur, non-judicial process, the principles of equity should prevail to allow a substantive challenge to that underlying foreclosure sale. I did not ask at the beginning to reserve time, but I'd like to reserve the last 3 minutes, Your Honor.
All right. You may proceed.
If it pleases the court, my name is Mike Schabelsky. Along with Jeffrey O'Brien, we represent the Federal National Mortgage Association, popularly known as Fannie Mae. All of us, unquestionably, are sympathetic to the parish's situation, and indeed to the situation of anybody facing eviction. It is a terrible thing to have to endure. But the issue here before this court is a jurisdictional and otherwise technical statutory matter. The parishes seek to collaterally attack Fannie Mae's deed that it bought at the foreclosure sale. But general district courts lack jurisdiction to try title to realty, either through a direct attack or through a collateral attack, and that jurisdictional limitation carries over to appeals to the circuit court.
Mr. Schabelsky, there is an interesting contrast, if you will, in the cases between the words trying title and some of the older cases which use the term concerning title. And it seems to me that an argument could be made, the federal cases cites or seats sort of synthesizes Virginia's, what they believe Virginia's law to be in this subject. But it seems to me that an argument can be made that some of the older cases, Gales versus Trust and Corbett versus Dutt and Williamson versus Paxton, might very well stand for the proposition that if all we're dealing with is the possession of the property and not the complete title to the property, that someone whose possession is being attacked with a piece of paper that says it is the deed should be able or could be able to put on evidence that doesn't try the title and determine the issue for all times between all parties, but does address the issue of, as between these two parties, whether this document really gives the bank the right to possess. Why isn't there a difference between the terminology of trying title and the terminology of concerning title?
Yes, ma'am. The seminal case that uses the phrase concerning title is this court's decision from 1886 in Pennell versus Cole. That question and that phrase that was being analyzed there was not concerning either the jurisdiction of the courts not of record, nor the elements, strictly speaking, of the lawful detainer action and whether there could be a challenge, a collateral attack on title, but rather the state constitutional provision that gave this court appellate jurisdiction over any actions concerning title. And the question on appeal, and that was decided in that case, is whether an unlawful detainer action that is only adjudicating one aspect of title, the right to immediate possession, and not the complete bundle of sticks that go with fee simple, does that concern title when not all aspects of title are potentially at issue there? This court analyzed that and said, yes, it does concern title within the state constitutional sense, but in doing so made very clear that the issue involved in the unlawful detainer action is not what it calls the right to the property, I think what's called the legal term of jus proprietis, but simply the right to immediate possession. And so in that case, that was all that was decided there, and indeed the court went on to say in that decision that, quote, the question to be determined in such a case as unlawful detainer is to the right to possession. And to this end, the question of complete title is not the question to be determined.
Right.
But in the other cases that we actually deal with unlawful detainer and the elements of that action, the very first one, I believe, of record is Allen v. Gibson at 24 Virginia 468. It's an 1826 case. And that was an unlawful detainer action following a default on a mortgage and an assumption of a deed following foreclosure. And there the court made clear that this proceeding involves no question of title. The only question is who is entitled to immediate possession. And then subsequent to Pannell versus Coles in 1920.
But when they say it involves no question of title, aren't they talking about that very issue of trying title, who owns the entire bundle of sticks as opposed to possession?
What they're deciding is who is the title holder, who is the record owner on the recorded deed.
No, what they're deciding is who's entitled to possession.
Correct, but the only way that the plaintiff, the parishes, and any other homeowner here can remain in possession is by trying the title, by collaterally attacking the title. The deed is admitted of record, that's a judicial act. The General Assembly and this court has recognized that that deed can only be set aside in a direct challenge, in an original action brought in a circuit court. In a unlawful detainer action, the General Assembly, by statute, has authorized courts not of record to decide those as summary proceedings. And the only question is, who has the right to immediate possession?
Let me just stop right there. Your client's right of possession is based upon the trustee's deed from the foreclosure.
Correct.
And that deed gives a right of, you've got essentially constructive possession based upon the deed.
Correct.
Now, if the defendant is going to challenge that, then at that point the proceeding concerns title. Does not the General District Court have to at least hear what the allegations are in order to determine whether it has jurisdiction to continue with this particular unlawful detainer proceeding?
Title
has become at issue.
No, I don't think so, Your Honor, because the General District Court clearly has jurisdiction over unlawful detainer actions. The General Assembly has vested it with jurisdiction to do that.
But I think the conundrum is the General Assembly has vested it with the jurisdiction to decide unlawful detainer actions. There is a subset of unlawful detainer actions that concerns title, but the General District Court does not have jurisdiction to hear an unlawful detainer that's going to concern title. So should not the General District Court at that point dismiss it without prejudice so that the proceeding can be brought as an original proceeding in circuit court?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
Why?
The General Assembly has given the jurisdiction to the district courts to decide on lawful detainer actions.
Jurisdiction with the circuit court. Is that correct, or am I incorrect about that?
Be brought as original proceedings in the circuit court as well. But in these contexts, the General Assembly has directed that they can be brought in the general district courts, consistent with the statutory directive that they be summary proceedings. I think the potential source of confusion, Your Honors, goes back to what does title mean. As early as 1855, in this court's decision in Ollinger versus Shepherd at 53 Virginia 462, this court has made clear that title draws after it possession of property. That is a bedrock principle at law. If I am the title holder of the fee, and that title has been admitted to record of the circuit court as a judicial act, I then have, as a matter of common law, the right to possession.
Mr. Shabelsky, what if I print off a title on my computer, take it down to the clerk's office, have it properly registered with the clerk, and take your house? And I go into downtown Richmond General District Court, and I present them with the title that I printed off of my computer that has been recorded with the clerk. And your position is that you cannot tell the General District Court, wait a minute, Your Honor, Justice Powell just printed this off of her computer. You can't even say that because it would be trying title?
In other words, if there's a fraud,
you're saying there are no defenses.
It sounds harsh, but that is exactly what this court held in Merle versus Diggs, 84 Virginia 900 in 1888. There, it was an ejectment action.
But aren't ejectments different? Ejectments are trying title.
But in that case, the defendant claimed that the deed was fraudulent, false and fraudulent. That was a trustee's deed obtained at a foreclosure sale. The buyer of the sale brought an ejectment action to evict the former owner. The former owner claimed the deed of trust was a forgery, pursuant to which, and then therefore the foreclosure was improper. This court held that that deed could not be collaterally attacked on that basis, which is the exact type of challenge here.
But that wasn't an unlawful detainer.
What about Dotson versus Culpepper, where the court said Dotson recognized certain defenses to an unlawful detainer, again, this challenging the deed, held in violation of the laws of the state. His interest has expired. He has sold and conveyed the land. He has been evicted by title paramount. So it seems to me that Dotson recognized that there can be defenses to this title.
In that context, it's not defenses to a collaterally attack the deed of the plaintiff. The question is, now, is there a subsequent supervening title? Has the plaintiff subsequently sold the property? Has the plaintiff lost the title in a tax
held in state? Violation of the laws of the state, or held in violation of Fannie Mae's own rules and regulations, which say if there is a petition pending within 37 days, you can't foreclose. Let me ask one more question with regard to the inability to attack collaterally. Are you relying on Carper versus McDowell and
the town of Grundy decision?
McCauley and others for that proposition.
That you can't collaterally attack?
Yes.
A deed? I think the best case for that, Your Honor, is there's a long line of decisions based on Merle versus Diggs and the subsequent cases. And I would add here that below, before the circuit court, as they did in the briefs here, the parish has acknowledged, as you see on page 80, I believe, of the joint appendix, that the district court here lacks jurisdiction to try title, and that jurisdictional limitation carries over to the circuit court.
And I don't challenge that. I don't challenge that. I'm not challenging anything. I don't question that. My question comes down to, as I said earlier, this distinction between trying title, which we'll decide is between this party and the rest of the world, who owns this property, and the issue of possession, which says concerning title. To say that a homeowner has no basis, cannot put on any evidence with regard to what could potentially be either a defective or fraudulent piece of paper seems to me to go against the grain of a long line of our prior cases. But let me get back to the issue of collateral attack, because it seems to me that the cases on which you relied in your brief focus on not being able to attack the registration and the propriety of the registration of the paperwork for purposes of who's first in time, for example. There was a question as to whether the timing of this deed in Carper versus McDowell, and the inability to collaterally attack seems to come from that line of cases. And even within those cases, they indicate that registration does not establish the right to the property. So you can't collaterally attack that registration. But even McDowell seems to indicate that you may be able to at least bring forth defenses to the propriety of possession based on this deed.
I would submit not in an unlawful detainer action. The parishes here had ample remedies before the foreclosure to assert that there was a defect in the process and to enjoin it, as this court recognized not too long ago. And they have other remedies available in circuit court if they want.
But it's never been a defense to say you have more than one remedy. If this is indeed a remedy, it's just irrelevant that they may have other remedies.
Well, but to your point that there may be defenses, they must be able to raise this because they have to have a defense to this. The law, the common law, and the General Assembly gives them other rights. In this context, as historically understood for over 200 years, an unlawful detainer proceeding in a court not of record was not a vehicle to challenge the propriety or legitimacy of the
title.
Either directly or through collateral attack. It has never been, there's not a single case from this court ever allowing that. Thank you, Your Honors.
Rebuttal.
Just briefly to touch on a few issues raised by opposing counsel. The argument that the parishes had other remedies is essentially an argument of laches. They waited, slept on their rights, and shouldn't be permitted to challenge it in an unlawful detainer. The problem with that argument, I submit, is that there was a lawsuit filed challenging this underlying foreclosure sale, and the parishes asked the trial court to consolidate it. Fannie Mae opposed it. The logical endpoint of Fannie Mae's argument in this case has come out in this argument. If there's a deed recorded in the land records, none of the circumstances surrounding that deed matter. Can be obtained by fraud, can be a forged document. If you file in the general district court based on that deed, the defendant has no ability to challenge any issue with the deed.
Wouldn't the prudent thing be for the general district court judge to just stay the proceeding and let the original jurisdiction matter go forward in circuit court, come back to unlawful detainer when the collateral attack is finished?
Your Honor, I submit that that is a potential remedy to this problem. However, defendants like the parishes and other defendants in this circumstance can't always rely on the fact that the general district court is
okay,
going to
so the general district court's in a hurry and just whizzes through it and say, whatever, I'm just going to do this. They get a de novo appeal, and then they immediately ask the circuit court to stay the action while they file their proper direct attack on the foreclosure proceeding.
Respectfully, if this court holds that a defendant in a post-foreclosure unlawful detainer case has no ability to challenge the deed so long as they're in possession of the property and the plaintiff has a deed, I don't know what the good faith basis would be for an attorney to appeal that case to the circuit court. Just simply asking the court to stay it because you're filing a collateral case, I would be wary as a practical matter of filing that case, because if this court holds that there's no defense...
Is it not a de novo review?
It's de novo review so long as the Supreme Court of Virginia, the highest court in the state, hasn't spoken on the issue. If this court holds that there's no ability to challenge an unlawful detainer, I'm not sure that we would be able to relitigate that issue and ask the court for an extension or modification of existing law, because there would be clear law on that point. Lastly,
but that's not the holding, is it? The holding is consistent with the 200 years of cases that you can't challenge it in the general district court. I mean, what you really want is the statute to be changed on unlawful detainer, right? That would fix all this.
Your Honor, I think that, and I'm about to run out of time, but I hope I'll be permitted to answer the question fully. We're not asking for the statute to be changed. There's conflicting case law on this issue. The cases cited for the proposition by the appellee that you can't collaterally attack are all an apposite. They deal with challenging acknowledgments to deeds and notarizations and recordings. That's not the case here. We're asking that the court consider title in the unlawful detainer because the case necessarily concerns title. And in my opinion, the statute does not directly say either 8.01.124 or 8.01-126, the two unlawful detainer statutes, do not say you cannot try title. And you couldn't try title anyway because an unlawful detainer only resolves the issue of possession, and it's not res judicata as to title. Thank you for hearing me.
All right. Call the next case.